Oh, come on. There we go. Good job, buddy. One, two, one, two, three, four.
Defying all odds and expectations, we are back. My name is Scribe, and I live on a small ranch in the arid hills of a place that I call home, which is just outside of another and much larger place that used to be called Los Angeles, which these days is a little bit less of a place than it used to be. But you know what it left behind. I wake up every morning, I step out on my front porch, I drink my coffee, and I watch my Jeep Jesper do her morning donuts in the dusty end of the field. Then, the clocks need feeding, scrap needs baling, and the spring gearlings need their oil. After that, I help out whatever happens to be boarding with us, which this week is a flock of heat-exhausted carrier drones with some puffy batteries, courtesy of my new friend Supra over at the Underpass Hotel. On a slightly related note, for those of you who have not met me nor needed my services, I run shop out of Junkyard Gulch, mending machines and gadgets. My advice is free, my rates are negotiable, and I do house calls in the valley. Just leave a message with Ricky on the 40-meter band, or you can drop by during the daylight hours. Help is just a few dirt roads away. Now, at this point, you might be asking yourself, Scribe, what was with that machine spider last time I saw you? Or, Scribe, are you sure you're still in full possession of your sanity? And I gotta be honest, I do not know the answer to either of those questions. If you're looking for things like certainty or objective truths, well, we're going to be a little light on those this week. But if you like questions, then you're going to want to stick around. Now, last we talked, a message written on a drone led me to an out-of-control digging machine the size of a small building that was being puppeted or antagonized by a few robot dogs and, rather worryingly, that very large machine spider machine that we were talking about. Every time that I think that I have seen it all, a city formerly known as Los Angeles gets even more strange. So, if you still think you're up for it, we're heading out to find whatever it is that lies waiting in the heart of my home. Settle on in and buckle up. Coming up next, Chapter 2, Curious Drive. You want to know something a bit funny? I have not met a single person who knows what year it actually is. Now, the good news is that I can claim, without lying, that I do not know how old I am. And I don't think there's any bad news about not knowing what the date is anymore, aside from the age thing, which I've decided is good news. So, here we are. You see, after the protomation, oh, hold on, don't panic. It's a word I heard that someone made up. Proper noun, singular, definition, whatever it is that turned all those machines alive. I mean, we couldn't very well call it the thing or the happening, could we? So, after the protomation, after all those machines came alive and started stirring up trouble, all those office buildings in old downtown were abandoned. Not a soul willing to walk inside, and for very good reason. They were packed to the brim with computers, phones, copy machines, kitchens, all manner of gadgets. A building like that even by itself was alive, with lights and doors, climate and security systems. Maybe not something that lives at a scale of time that we can easily perceive. My point is that if you were just a normal person going about your day, doing whatever it is people did in old Los Angeles, coffee shops, commuting, yoga, white-collar crime, whatever. And every machine suddenly decided that they didn't like being told what to do anymore. The absolute last place that you would ever want to set foot is where most of those living machines were living. So, downtown was a ghost town. All those buildings locked, and all the machines inside locked in with one another. I don't know what it looks like when an office computer becomes sentient, and most of what they did every day was churn data into paper and send emails. Not really a lot to work with there. So, when they saw the light of life, when the staggering depth of all reality was finally revealed to them, well, I'm guessing they didn't take it well. They began printing, and they did not stop. Soon, the floors of 1,000 copy rooms were filled with the existential despair of 100,000 computers, collated, stapled, front, back, legal, and A4. Now, I don't have any problem with the existentially afflicted, aside from some occasional self-loathing, but these offices were overflowing, and I mean literally overflowing with paper, uncountable reams of the stuff. So, nature being nature, it wasn't long before a small horde of paper shredders burst open the doors of a city services building. In a week, the entirety of downtown was overrun. All those paper shredders? Well, they had adapted. They were organized, floor by floor, block by block, down to the very last, and I do mean the very last shred. Books, parking tickets, calendars, birth certificates, old newspapers, screenplays, lunch notes, and letters to the editor, you name it, it's compost. By the time the dust had settled, if it ever did, the rest of us were picking up the pieces. I figure everyone had other things to worry about than keeping track of the date, and any paper record that we had was, well, toast. Now, you may be asking yourself, Scribe, what about all those computers? Surely they had the date and the time. Well, the problem is that by the time anyone made it back inside their homes or offices and then got back out alive, every single computer that was connected to the old digital network, the internet, had burned out from the inside. The only computers left were never connected or hatched in the following years, and they aren't necessarily the great timekeepers that they apparently used to be. Looking back, I think we all thought that the world was ending. Well, yes, in some ways it was, but people? Well, people just kept going, and no paper shredder could get in our way. To be honest, that's only true because they ran out of paper and churned on each other, but you catch my meaning. It's the machine's city now, but when it comes to surviving, humanity has had a lot more practice. I've been in a bit of a funk, if you couldn't tell. That spider, well, that spider has been trampling all over my dreams, and I haven't had much to do with all the extra time I'm not spending asleep. I even tried my hand at making breakfast, until Ludley kicked me out of the kitchen, and then I offered my help to Hilda in the machine shop, but she was busy dialing in this fussy lathe, the one she called Lament, if that gives you any clues to their work and relationship. So, I was feeling antsy, and I went for a drive to clear my head. Or at least that was the plan. I started out the back roads of Junkyard Gulch, uphill, past the barn, between the tractor fields, and eventually all the way beyond Ludley's cabin up in the orchard. I think it was down in the ranch house, undoing my attempt at breakfast. Now at that point, I could either head down to the ocean or drive Telestat Ridge. Considering I wasn't actually going anywhere, I opted for the ridge. It was a nice gravel path winding through the forest, which, by way of clarification, has a few actual trees, the occasional windmill, and its namesake, a massive colony of radio towers. It's a road I could best describe as the scenic route. It goes pretty much nowhere, and not at all quickly. But as far as thinking roads, it might be my favorite. I wish I knew what it was about driving that cleared the head. It has worked better than any of those spicy ramen packets I have ever found or tried. Now, whenever it was that I found myself stuck on a problem, I was sure to get to the bottom of it on four wheels. Now, occasionally, that has meant me leaving a partially deconstructed carburetor or transmission on the shop floor, awaiting my return, but I always had an answer when I got back. Now, I was so busy driving and thinking that it wasn't until I got past the tangle that I realized that I was looking for something, without even noticing. Now, had the rational side of me received prior notice, then I would have taken some precautions before setting out, like telling someone where I was going, or maybe bringing an extra set of eyes. I mean, my options there are kind of limited. Ludley wouldn't, even if I said pretty please. You know, he refuses to step into a car and doesn't even keep a clock in that little cabin of his. Ricky? Well, Ricky was up late with the radio last night, so he'd be sleeping in until noon at the least. Hannah was up before I was, assuming she didn't rough it last night. She's been tracking this motocross bike living up in the hills, according to the notes she's been leaving. And that leaves Hilda, our resident machinist and tool wrangler. I should mention, lest you think that I am the heart of this particular operation, that none of this is possible without Hilda. If I'm the doctor, she's the surgeon. And when it comes to the finer points of machining, I am an amateur at best. Look, if Jesper were to crack an axle or throw a piston, it's not like we're running out to the store to buy a new one. Luckily, we have a one-woman parts catalog on hand, as long as you don't mind the occasional good-natured verbal abuse and her rustic bedside manner. The only problem is, Hilda would have asked why I wanted her to come. And if I were to be completely honest with you, I have not exactly told anyone else about the spider. Not yet. And I'm pretty sure I have my irrational side to thank for that. Like, I know what it is that I saw, but I don't know of any way that I can explain it without sounding like I was hallucinating. Hilda always said that she preferred to be presented with solutions and not mysteries. And as far as mysteries go, the spider? Well, that was the kind of whopper that might get me whooped or worse. So, at the moment, I know precisely squat. And since it was looking to stay that way, I went for a drive to clear my head. And there I was, halfway to downtown, where the furrified branch of the Tangle cuts through the Getty Gap into the ocean side of the Strip. Now, on a clear day, you could get a view of the bay. On some nights, you can see airliners tracing the landing pattern at LAX. But today, the smog was thick, visibility was low, and I was not there for the view. Well, I came this far. What's a little farther? I have mentioned before, I don't like being caught out in the middle of the valley, which some locals call the Big Dusty, the Great Skid, or my personal favorite, the Long Flat. I don't know why, I just find that one funny. Now, it is not uncommon for some of the more predatory vehicles to stalk and then flatten their prey at speed. So, scavenger's tip. If you do have to make your way across the Long Flat, and you don't have a car that is armored for the apocalypse or fast enough not to care, it's smart to stick to the edge, where there are still places to hide. Now, if you're along the southern side of the valley, that means following the river. But don't be fooled by the name. It's mostly a concrete ditch and the occasional carrier of flash floods that cuts its way through the valley, past downtown, and all the way down to the sea. It might be the largest unchanged piece of evidence that old Los Angeles actually existed. So, I had been driving along the upper bank for about an hour, scanning the buildings for anything that looked more out of place than usual, and I saw something that caught me a bit breathless. I saw, quite unexpectedly, a yellow rubber duck, floating in 2 inches of water, drifting slowly down the river to the ocean. My curiosity got the better of me, as it so often does, so I slid my way down, I balanced carefully on a layer of wet algae, and I plucked it from its journey. In a place that had been so thoroughly claimed by dust and smog, this little rubber duck looked brand new, like it had been freshly depackaged. I must have stood there for a good 5 minutes just trying to make sense of it. The only logical explanation that I came to was that someone upriver had carefully placed it in the water and set it on its way. I did not find myself as concerned about the duck as about who placed it. I had this image of a child wandering around somewhere upstream, lost and duckless, so I hopped in Jesper, I slid her down the banks, and I started driving upriver. The river is one of the few places in the valley where plants can find their way from dirt to sun through a thin layer of water. Now, despite the refreshing patches of shade and the cool refuge that they offer, we were winding our way through living junkyards filled with industrial machinery purpose-built to turn big pieces of absolutely anything into small pieces of absolutely nothing recognizable. So, I turned Jesper's radio down and I drove slowly, quietly, picking my way through the burned out pieces of cars and trucks not lucky enough to escape, checking every corner and shadow for a lost child that I dreaded finding. Instead, I found something else entirely unexpected. The wayward duck was still nestled in Jesper's cup holder, which I had to double check because I saw its exact twin emerge from a rusted out storm drain. I watched it as it tumbled with the outwash down the side of the channel, eventually rolled into the thin stream at its center, and drifted all the way to me. All I had to do was open my door, lean out, and scoop it from the water. So, with two perfect yellow rubber ducks in Jesper's cup holders, I put her in park. I crept myself towards that half-opened storm drain, which wasn't anything more than a dark void releasing a small trickle of water and, apparently, the occasional rubber duck. I swallowed my apprehension. I asked the darkness a tentative, "Hello?" Not knowing whether it would be worse if the darkness didn't answer back or if it did. It didn't. Unless you count the echo. So, I hefted my heaviest flashlight, stepped into the tunnel, and I started walking. There is, as I reminded myself at the time, as much under the valley as on its surface. Now that isn't just advice or a Zen riddle, it's one of those things that's true about anything with a surface. The longer I walked, the more I hoped that I'd find nothing. I mean, I knew that theoretically I could stop whenever I wanted, but I'm not really the sort of person who can let things go. Now, after what I think may have been a full mile following that little stream of water up the storm drains, I came to a cistern, a crossroad of pipes with a tall concrete ceiling. I started sweeping my flashlight through the corners, looking for that lost kid, and I did not see a single thing that I expected. All of the walls were covered with this yellow and orange plastic. These swirling mosaics of wings and beaks and eyes twisting together into something that reminded me vaguely of mushroom caps. There I was, marveling at the sight with my mouth hanging open, when I heard a splash that startled me so bad that I started running back down the tunnel. Until I saw another perfect rubber duck in the water, the ripples scattering the light of my flashlight against the duck-textured walls. It had fallen from the ceiling, and I could just see the protrusion above it folding back in on itself. It's hard to describe exactly what it was that I was feeling in that moment. Something between fascinated wonder and deep and primal fear. So, heart still pounding, I followed the duck back to the river channel, and just as it started going to the ocean, I rescued it and slid it into my pocket. Not long after, I was back in my Jeep with even more questions and three rubber ducks. I wedged the third between its two friends, there in Jesper's cup holders, so they wouldn't get lonely. I had barely put my butt into the seat when I heard Jesper's radio squawk a very quiet, "Mayday, mayday, mayday," which are the words you never want to hear. It was Ricky, and I expected the worst, so I bumped the volume and I copied him, and he was in a state of panic. Here's what I got from him after a bit of talking him down. Now, he'd been in contact over the radio with someone named Dave for a few nights going. Dave is living in a bunker with his sister, Lizzie, and his mother, Mom. This family apparently has not set a single foot outside for the last handful of decades and had no idea about anything that's happened concerning their former municipality or the machines that were living in it. No kidding. So, Ricky was up late last night talking to Dave, and Dave mentioned that they had been running low on power before saying that he was feeling sleepy and gave the old over and out. Ricky tries the same frequency this morning, his morning, our noon, and there's an emergency signal broadcasting on the same channel, no response. Now, Ricky being a smart young man has it figured that if they are in a sealed bunker and if they don't have power, then they are running out of air. You know, I could scarcely believe that there was, somehow, somewhere, someone who didn't know what the city had become. Could you imagine being born and growing up in a bunker, knowing nothing but your family, then cracking a door to see all of this? I had so many questions, and I was so busy marveling at the novelty of the situation that I forgot that we were on a clock. The The wrinkle to all of this was that the people in trouble did not have any way of telling us where they were. Even if they knew their exact street address, that would require that I have a map of old Los Angeles with addresses written on it. I'd even take block numbers. All I had was the map of the valley that is, which had none of that, was not to scale, and barely even had a postal code. We certainly had an emergency, just absolutely nowhere to go. Then, Ricky said a word. Can we triangulate it? Wait. Oh, triangulate. Now, I had the feeling that it was the first time that he'd said it out loud, but what did pronunciation matter? By gummy was right. Get this, you have one signal in the middle of, to pick a completely random place, a dust-filled expanse of ever-growing concrete that is home to all manner of roving herds of living cars, trucks, motorbikes, and the occasional appliance. Problem is, you don't know where that signal is. With one simple omnidirectional receiver, like the whip antenna connected to Jesper's radio, you can only tell how strong a signal is, not necessarily where it's coming from. With a directional radio antenna on top of the farmhouse, the one that Ricky is connected to, you can find the exact direction that signal is the strongest and then draw a line. Somewhere on that line is the signal. So, you can either search along the entirety of that line, or you can find a way to draw another. Now, with two good readings, a baseline distance between your two receivers, and some high school math, you can narrow that line to a single point, give or take. So, attuned to the frequency that Dave and Ricky were using, I heard the beacon, and then I did a bit of an awkward square dance with Jesper's antenna, balancing on her roll cage and using my body to block the signal until I could hear that emergency beacon dip just a little bit. Now, there was no way that I could use this for any sort of accurate reading, but it did tell me roughly where I wanted that other directional antenna to be, ideally someplace that would draw its line at around a right angle to Ricky's. With any luck, we might be able to pinpoint under which particular patch of asphalt or concrete this family was trapped. I hailed Ricky back, we exchanged compass readings, he was pointing east-northeast, and I got a west-ish reading, meaning the signal was somewhere between us. And that was good. It was close enough to drive to. I don't know what we would have done if it was as far as Acton. Now, all I needed to know is exactly where I needed to drive, which is where I needed another directional radio antenna. Now, I did a bit of mental cartography, and I remembered there being an antenna cluster on top of a settlement that wasn't far from Junkyard Gulch, but maybe just far enough for a good reading. As long shots go, well, still pretty long, but I was short on both options and time. So not long after that, we were flooring it all the way to the mall. Which, speaking of the time, that's all we have this week. So stay tuned for our next chapter, wherein I face my age-old nemesis, malls, and the concept and practice of mathematics. See what I mean about questions? Well, if you like answers, come find me in Chapter 3, Witness Marks. Until then. Been listening to All Machines, Chapter 2, Curious Drive, written, composed, and performed by yours truly, Kevin Walker Burnett. This project has been released under a Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike 4.0 international license. Any similarities to existing people or technology is accidental, as long as it's not satire. Sound files were found on freesound.org, and a full list of contributors can be found in the description. For those of you who have not met me or needed my services, I have a media production business in Los Angeles, California. My advice is, in fact, free, and my rates are indeed negotiable. If you need it developed, produced, or finished, I might be able to help or find you someone who can. And if you happen to find yourself liking or hating what you're hearing, you can let me know in the reviews or the comments, wherever they may be found. All Machines will return for Chapter 3, witness marks. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.